This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Public education in America needs to be improved. You can get a lot of agreement on that statement. But how to do it? That's where you run into big disagreements. Later, we'll hear from Andrew Rotherham, an education consultant and policy analyst who supports strategies to redesign American public education with the help of charter schools, public sector choice, testing, and accountability. My first guest, Diane Ravitch, had been an advocate of choice, testing, accountability, and market-based education reform. Now, she has profound doubts about these same ideas. She says she was persuaded by accumulating evidence that these reforms were not likely to live up to their promise. Diane Ravitch's latest book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System: How Testing and Choice Undermine Education. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education in the George W. Bush administration. President Clinton appointed her to the National Assessment Governing Board, which oversees federal testing of student progress in different subject areas. She served on that board for 7 years. Diane Ravitch is a professor of education at NYU and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Diane Ravitch, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, you were an early advocate of No Child Left Behind and test-based accountability of schools and teachers with related rewards and punishments. Let's start with the theory behind that. When you supported it, what did you think was going to work about that?
Well, I supported test-based accountability for years, thinking that if we could just measure whether kids are learning year after year, we could focus in on what the problems were. The test could be used diagnostically, in effect, to identify what children's needs are, and that would enable schools to focus on the kids and do better. I had never imagined that the test would someday be turned into a blunt instrument to close schools or to say whether teachers are good teachers or not, because I always knew that children's test scores are far more complicated than the way they're being received today. But the original idea was just that you could help kids and you could help teachers and you could help schools do a better job by focusing on whether kids were learning. It didn't turn out to work that way.
So how are the test results used to close schools or to punish teachers?
Well, when No Child Left Behind was passed, I don't think that the Congress gave serious thought to what the ultimate results would be down the line. They had some very severe remedies or punishments in the law. For instance, saying that if a school didn't improve its test scores for every single group in the school, and if you weren't on track to be 100% proficient for every single child by the year 2014, which is for some reason a magical year, then the school would be subjected to severe punishments. The punishments would grow year by year until eventually the school would either be turned into a charter school, it would be handed over to private management, it would be closed, or half the staff would be fired and the principal would be fired. This is called turning around a school. But we've reached the point now where Secretary Duncan said not long ago that more than 80% of the schools are going to be labeled failing in the next year. So I came to the conclusion and said in the book, I said that No Child Left Behind has turned into a timetable for the destruction of American public education.
When the neighborhood school closes, where do the students go? To another neighborhood school?
No, what happens is that new schools are opened, and then the new schools, in some cases, are allowed to winnow out the low-performing kids. So then the administration, the central district, can say, well, see, our new schools are doing better. But if they're not educating the same kids, then they're not doing better. The kids who are low-performing tend to get kicked around like checkers on a checkerboard or pieces on a chessboard. They get pushed out of one school after another because everybody knows that they'll drag their scores down, and school people, whether they're in charters and regular public schools, try to avoid the kids who have the biggest problems.
You know, I haven't seen any of the No Child Left Behind tests. What do the tests measure? What kind of questions do they ask?
Well, No Child Left Behind leaves every state to devise its own test, and they all go to the same commercial test makers, and the tests are overwhelmingly multiple-choice standardized tests. So what happens is that teachers spend an inordinate amount of time preparing children to take tests. So they'll have the test from the last several years, and they'll study the questions and take those tests over and over and over so that when they get the next year's test, the next test will basically ask the same question but change the numbers a little bit or just change the wording slightly, and the children are then prepared. But all that testing and test preparation has fattened the testing industry. I mean, it's now a multi-billion dollar industry beyond their wildest dreams. And it's stolen time from good education.
Some schools, and I think this is particularly true in neighborhoods that are poor with a lot of violence, that the violence comes through in the school too. Children are under attack. Teachers are under attack. There was just a long series in the Philadelphia Inquirer about violence in the Philadelphia public schools. And it's hard for teachers to teach. It's hard for students to learn. And I think people have been in despair for so long about the state of some inner city schools. So you're saying shutting them down isn't the answer. No one's come up with a good answer.
Well, what you're describing is not failing schools. You're describing failing communities. You're describing communities where people are living desperate lives, where there's homelessness, where there's violence, where there's criminal activity, where children are subject to all kinds of abuse. And these are failing communities. And we as a nation have failed to do anything about the social dysfunction in our midst and then turn around and say the whole fault, the blame lies with teachers. Let's fire teachers. There's something wrong there, and that doesn't make any sense, that the teachers are as much the victims as the children are.
Let's take a look at charter schools, another example of a type of school that you changed your mind about. So let's start with an explanation of what charter schools are and how they were started.
Well, charter schools originally were the idea of Albert Shanker, who was the president for many years of the American Federation of Teachers, which is a teachers union. And his idea was that a group of teachers could say to their colleagues, let us start a small school with your permission, and we will go out into the streets, recruit the kids who dropped out, recruit the kids who are about to drop out, and let us see what we can do to come up with ideas that will help make public education better. And it'll be a collaborative venture. That was the original idea. What has happened, and also why Shanker himself turned against his idea a few years after he proposed it, is that it has become an enormous entrepreneurial activity, and the private sector has moved in, and it's now become a vehicle for privatization. And so there are charter chains where the executives are paying themselves $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year. They compete with regular public schools. They do not see themselves as collaborators with public schools, but as business competitors. And in some cases, they actually want to take away the public school space and drive the public school out of business. So it's very different from the idea as it started. And charter schools in cities like New York and in other schools where the charters are co-located in public buildings have become a source of dissension and conflict, setting parent against parent. Now, the idea that I've always thought was very attractive was that it takes a village to raise a child, but charter schools end up pitting parent against parent, teacher against teacher, and leading to not the village collaborating around children, but the village fighting over space and over who's better than whom.
How does a charter school turn parent against parent, teacher against teacher, in your opinion?
Well, charters in New York, for example, where I live, will flood, as they put it, flood the zone with literature about how the new charter that they're opening is going to be so much better than the regular public schools. And they will spend literally hundreds of thousands of dollars on marketing and publicity for their new charter. And so a lottery is held, thousands of parents turn out, and there are 75 or 100 seats available. So thousands of parents go away disappointed. The regular public school parents are angry because space in their building has been taken away. They no longer have an art room. They no longer have a computer room. Whatever space they had for extra activities gets taken away and given to the charters. And then the charters get better facilities. They have a lot of philanthropic money behind them. Wall Street hedge fund managers have made this their favorite cause. So at least in this city and in some others as well, they are better funded. They may not get as much public funds, but the private funds they get are far more than the public funds that they don't get. So they have better everything, and the kids in the regular public school begin to feel like they're second-class citizens.
You're making it sound like it's a bad thing when a hedge fund contributes money to help a charter school. I mean, people feel really good about giving money to education. You're making it sound like it's a problem.
Well, here's why I think it's a problem, and it's because I step back, and I'm a historian, And I look at the data from studies across the world, and what I see is that the best performing nations in the world have strong public education systems. I don't see any of the high performing nations handing over control of children and in the public sector and handing over public funding to entrepreneurs. I see them instead building a public school system, building and strengthening their education profession so that their teachers are the best, so that they're well supported, so that they feel passionate and energetic about the work they're doing. And we seem to be doing the opposite. We're privatizing many of our public schools. We're demoralizing the people who work in the regular public schools. We're doing, as a nation, at this moment in time, doing nothing to improve our public school system and everything to undermine it.
What about the Jeffrey Canada model, the Harlem Children's Zone? And this is a zone of nearly 100 blocks that's supposed to nurture and protect children from birth on. I mean, it starts with a baby college in which first-time soon-to-be parents learn how to take care of a baby so that they're prepared when the baby's born, and then the program's supposed to, you know, provide like adult assistance and mentoring throughout the child's formative years in school and outside of school.
Well, I actually love the Harlem Children's Zone model. I don't love that Jeffrey Canada has become a spokesman for privatization, because Jeffrey Canada has far more resources than any public school in his neighborhood or in any neighborhood. He has a board of trustees with very, very wealthy people on it who provide, I think the last time I looked at the 990 forms for the Harlem Children's Zone, it had $200 million in assets. So they're able to have very small classes. They are an anti-poverty program. They don't say, as far as I know, that resources don't matter, because they are amply funded with resources. So it would be very hard to compare the Harlem Children's Zone to regular public schools, which in Harlem don't have resources anything near what he has.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Diane Ravitch, and she's a historian of education, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education in the Bush administration, and she's now a research professor at NYU's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. Her latest book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. The current Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, has started a program called Race to the Top. How does that compare to No Child Left Behind?
Race to the Top is an extension of No Child Left Behind. It contains all of the punitive features. It encourages states to have more charter schools. What it said in its, when it invited proposals from states, was you need to have more charter schools. You need to have merit pay, which is a terrible idea. You need to judge teachers by test scores, which is an even worse idea. And you need to be prepared to turn around low-performing schools. So this is what many state legislatures adopted, hoping to get money from Race to the Top. Only 11 states in the District of Columbia did get that money. These are all bad ideas. None of them are ideas that will help schools. They're all schools that work on the free market model, that with more incentives and sanctions and with more competition, schools will somehow magically get better.
Teachers' unions have been criticized a lot lately. The Wisconsin legislature passed a bill that's now in the courts that would eliminate most collective bargaining rights of the teachers' union. Teachers' union tenure systems have been blamed for schools' inability to fire incompetent teachers. In the movie Waiting for Superman, which is very critical of the public school system, it describes what is commonly known as the rubber room, a room where teachers in New York awaiting disciplinary hearings, and they wait an average of 3 years, spend their workday in this holding room where they're not teaching. They're not allowed to teach at that moment, but they're getting their full pay. So what's your assessment of the pros and cons of teachers' unions today?
Well, the first thing you have to understand about teachers' unions is that they're not the problem. The state with the highest scores on the national test, the ones given by the federal government, that state is Massachusetts, which is 100% union. The nation with the highest scores in the world is Finland, which is 100% union. Management and labor can always work together around the needs of children if they're willing to. I think what's happening in Wisconsin, and not just in Wisconsin, but also in Ohio and Florida and Indiana and in other states, is very, very conservative right-wing governors want to break the unions because the unions provide support to the Democratic Party. But the unions are really not the problem in education. Just to give you an example, you mentioned the rubber room in New York. The rubber room consisted of teachers who had been accused but had not had a hearing. Generally, in our country, we have a principle that until you have had a hearing and until you've been found guilty, you're innocent. So the rubber room was filled with people who had not had a hearing and yet were judged to be guilty by Waiting for Superman. Waiting for Superman, by the way, I reviewed it in the New York Review of Books. And the producers of the film are very supportive of vouchers and free market strategies to school reform and everything else. So I think that film has to be taken with not just a grain of salt, but understood to be a pro-privatization film.
You write a little bit about the history of unions in your latest book, of the teachers' union, and you talk about how the union was created at a time when teachers were largely women, and there were specific needs that the women had and specific things they had to be protected from.
Well, yes, the unions were created because teachers didn't have a profession. And by the way, tenure long predates the unions. Tenure goes back to the 1880s. It was part of civil service reform, and the unions didn't create tenure. But people, the teachers wanted to collectively bargain because alone and an individual is powerless. And yet, as part of a union, they have power in negotiations for their working conditions and for wages and benefits. And because the teaching profession not only was predominantly female, but is still predominantly female, it became important for women to have and for teachers to have a collective voice, because otherwise they were at the whim of very paternalistic boards of education. There were cities, and I know New York was one of them, there were others as well, where women would be fired if they got married, where teachers would be fired if they got married, not men teachers, but female teachers would be fired. If they then were married and got pregnant, they would be fired if they were pregnant. So they had no job rights, and they were, I won't say oppressed, but certainly they had meager salaries, no pensions, and when they retired, it was to a retirement of poverty. And so unions have made it possible for teachers to have a decent living and also a decent pension so that they don't retire into poverty.
So many of the public schools are such a mess now in terms of learning and safety that, you know, a lot of people say, just, like, blow up the system. You can never fix the system. So, like, blow it up and start from scratch or blow it up and privatize it. But don't expect to really reform the public school system because there's too much bureaucracy to do it. You just can't make change in an effective way. What do you say to that?
You know, I have friends from some of my conservative think tank days who believe that. Those friends, of course, went to very elite boarding schools and sent their children to elite boarding schools where class sizes were 12 to 15. And they were paying, of course, lots more than most people pay for public education. I think that is a dramatic overstatement, and I would refer you to the latest Gallup poll about public education. The public has been so bombarded for so many years about how terrible public education is that there's a very low estimate of public schools, and you're correct. 18% said public education is doing a good job and give it an A or a B. But then when the poll said, how do you feel about your own child's school, the one that you know best? 77% said, oh, my own child's school is great. 77%, that's the highest rating that their own child's school has gotten in the history of the poll, which I think goes back some 25 years of asking that question. So I think that the it's not true that public education is a mess. We have some great public schools. And it's like every other thing we've been discussing today, whether it's privatization, choice, vouchers, charter schools, and now this incredibly excessive testing and this narrowing of the curriculum where we end up deleting or not having time for history, for civics, for the arts, for science, because testing focuses everybody just on reading and math. We are destroying our education system, blowing it up by these stupid policies, and handing the schools in low-income neighborhoods over to private entrepreneurs does not in itself improve them. There's plenty of evidence by now that the kids in those schools do know better, and it's simply a way of avoiding the public responsibility to provide good education.
Diane Ravitch, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Diane Ravitch is the author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier in our show, Diane Ravitch explained why she's become disillusioned with school reforms she once supported, like No Child Left Behind and charter schools. My guest, Andrew Rotherham, supports testing, accountability, charter schools, and choice as important strategies in redesigning public education. Rotherham is an education consultant and policy analyst. He co-founded Bellwether Education Partners, a nonprofit organization working to improve educational outcomes for low-income students. He writes the column School of Thought for Time.com. He's the author of 4 books about education policy. Although he supports charter schools as an important part of reforming education in America, he says depending on the student and the community, a charter school isn't necessarily the best option.
Parents should not get hung up on this label of charter or traditional public, or frankly private for that matter. Schools are schools, and they're going to be a good fit for your child or not. They're going to be performing well or not, depending on a variety of factors. And you can find examples of excellence, and you can find examples of acute failure in all sectors, whether they're in the charter sector, whether they're in the traditional public school sector.
Can you give us an example of a charter school whose success you'd like to see used as a model?
Sure, I can give you an example of a bunch. And so these can be sort of individual schools. So, for example, like the Match School in Boston is a really terrific school focused on getting kids into college. There's networks of schools like Achieving
First. This is a high
First.
School?
Match School is a high school. There's networks of schools like Achievement First, Uncommon Schools. Obviously, KIPP is sort of a household name in the debate. And then there's schools like here in Washington, D.C. There's a school called the Seed School. It's a public boarding school. And when you tell people about it, you say, you know, it's a public boarding school where the kids come in on Sunday nights and they leave on Fridays. People think, well, that's a crazy idea. That could never happen. And yet we have this school, and it's been operating in Washington. They're opening a new one in Maryland and thinking about expanding elsewhere. And that's actually more than anything else what I would like to see replicated is that sense of possibility. So these are good schools. There's sort of technical things they do that we can talk about, whether it's the way they hire teachers, evaluate performance, use data. But I think more than anything else, the thing I'd like to see replicated is that sort of ethos of possibility and thinking differently about what's possible for kids that have been really failed by public schools for a very long time. That sense of thinking big and really doing things different in an effort to change outcomes for them. And those schools all in different ways sort of provide proof points. And that's what I, more than anything else, that ethos is what I'd like to see.
Yeah, but, you know, there's charter schools that have tried things and have failed, and charter schools that have tried things and that have succeeded in getting better results. So give us an example of one or two things that you've seen charter schools try that you think actually work in improving the educational environment.
Sure, and I'm not trying to be deliberately vague, but I'll say the thing is, and this, you can do this in traditional public schools too, it's nothing magic about charters, it's intentionality. The very best schools, they are intentional about everything they do. They're intentional about who is in the building, who is teaching, how they use data, what's happening for students, the experience for students, the support for students, the curriculum, how progress is assessed. Everything is intentional and nothing is left to chance. That's, again, nothing to do with the charter as much as simply the freedom to sort of build that kind of community. And too often in traditional public schools, whether it's through inertia and the buildup of regulations, whether it's through different various rules in contracts or state law, things happen in different ways that aren't as intentional. When you're in the best schools, again, whether they're charter schools or traditional public schools, that intentionality about everything they do, it is inescapable. And that is more important, Terry, than the particular method. You can be in schools that have different educational philosophies and are very good schools, but what they have in common is that intentionality about what they're doing. You really can't you can't escape that, and you just don't see success in places where they're not intentional about what they're doing.
Have you given up on public schools?
Oh, absolutely not. Look, I'm a product of public schools. I couldn't do the work that I do if I didn't believe in the possibility and the promise of public schools. most students are going to continue to be educated in the public schools. There's all this talk about virtual and so forth. Most parents don't have the luxury of educating their kids at home, so public schools may start to look different, but kids are still going to go to school. There's sort of a basic custodial function. And so the work I do, and I really think the big ball game, is about how do you make public schools better? How do you make them work for more kids? They worked great for me, but I grew up in a nice suburb outside of Washington, D.C. If I had been born just a few miles away, I would have had a very different public education experience. That's the challenge. It's not about giving up on public schools, but it is about acknowledging that right now, when you step back, this country, 8% of low-income kids can expect to get a bachelor's degree by the time they're 24. I mean, just stop right there. That is a stunning figure. And so all this rhetoric about are we giving up on public schools, are they working or not, I don't know how anybody can look at that figure and not say we need to come together and really get much more serious about not just improving a little bit, not just changing a little bit, but dramatically changing what we're doing in public education so we can do a better job for the kids who really need it the most.
I know there's some concern from people who work in public schools that charter schools and vouchers are taking the best students away from your average public school, and that the most motivated parents and most motivated students are seeking the alternative schools. Now, on one hand, you can argue, well, great for them. They should go to the best schools possible. On the other hand, you can argue, but the public schools now are being left with the students who are less motivated and who aren't trying to get into the best schools, and makes those schools more difficult to teach in, more difficult to learn in, and those schools are kind of being doomed to perform at a lower level.
You know, it's complicated place by place, and you have a few places where, you know, charters have achieved a really significant market share. So, for example, Washington, D.C. is a very noteworthy example of that, increasingly in Los Angeles. But in most places, charters are still not a sort of enormous presence on the landscape. You know, there's 5,000 public charter schools around the country. There's about 100,000 traditional public schools, so you can do the math. So there's sort of two takeaways from this. One is one of the things that makes charter schools attractive is the fact they aren't non-selective. They take kids open admission or by lottery, and so you're not creating sort of a selective set of public schools. That's again one of the things that makes them attractive. The second sort of the bottom line issue is there is more choice coming to education. Choice comes to all American industries, and education's one of the last ones that sort of has resisted that. And so the challenge for public schools is how do you make in these communities make the public schools not the choice of last resort, but the first choice for parents? That's the imperative now. The competition is going to continue to be there. Different kinds of schools, different kinds of options. And frankly, parents are going to continue to do for their own children the very best that they can, whether that's move to different communities, avail themselves of other options and so forth. And so the challenge for the public schools is how do you make the public schools really the first choice for parents? And you don't get there through sort of a lot of rhetoric. We get there by rolling up our sleeves and really improving the quality of schooling in a lot of these communities.
Well, the question arises, is it the school that's failing the students, or is it poverty that has put students in a position where they're likely to fail?
Poverty plays a huge role. Schools play a huge role, too, and there are a lot of things that schools can do to help ameliorate the problems that kids bring to school. And we know that both from the overall data, and we know that from plenty of very compelling examples. It's oversimplifies it to say it's just schools, and if schools just did this, we wouldn't have these other issues. But what you do see, looking across the country, is different schools produce different outcomes with similar kids. So there are things schools do that matter. You have sort of schools serving high-poverty kids. You have schools that do that, and those kids are graduating. Those kids are going off to college. You have schools that do that with abysmal outcomes. We see differences in teacher effects and the effectiveness of teachers and how much they improve achievements. So there are levers that schools can pull to help address this problem. And what too frequently happens with this conversation about poverty is people just want to throw up their hands. The reality is poverty is an issue. It's an extremely challenging issue, but schools can do much more to address it than they do today.
What can they do? What can schools do to address the problem of poverty?
Sure. As I said earlier, they can be intentional about making sure the kids who come to school with the least are getting the most. So they're getting the most effective teachers. They're getting a rich, high-quality curriculum. They are supported in school. There is sort of rigorous intentionality. They get extra time. They get everything that they need to succeed to give them the best chance of succeeding. And that, what I just described, is really a mirror image or the exact opposite, if you will, of what happens today. Again, from everything from how much money is spent on these schools to how they're staffed, these kids tend to get the least. And that's why we see the outcomes that we see. And sort of underneath sort of all the rhetoric about these various things, that's the problem that we need to solve if we're serious about improving equity. And by the way, in a lot of these communities, we also have an insufficient supply of financial services, grocery stores, healthcare services. I mean, these are underserved communities in general, and they're underserved on education as well. And on these other issues, we're all, you know, I think there's a general agreement, at least there's a general agreement sort of from the center left to the left, that the way to solve these problems is get those services in there, you know, make sure that people have access to those things. Schools are so political that we have this entirely different conversation. We should be having the exact same conversation. How do you open more good public schools in these communities? Those can be charter schools. They can be district-run schools. They can be contract schools. There's a lot of ways to address that. But the problem is right now, parents in those communities have too few choices.
We're talking about reforming the education system in America. My guest is Andrew Rotherham, a consultant on education reform and education policy, and a former member of the Virginia Board of Education. He's a partner at Bellwether Education, a nonprofit organization working to improve educational outcomes for low-income students. The Bush administration created No Child Left Behind. The Obama administration created Race to the Top. Both of those programs rely on testing to evaluate how teachers and schools are performing. How would you describe the difference between the two programs?
So No Child Left Behind was passed in 2001. It was basically a bipartisan effort to build on what had happened during the 90s with standards-based reform, but address some of the problems, particularly that states had set varying standards and there weren't a lot of consequences for schools that persistently, year after year, weren't doing well. So No Child Left Behind was really about sort of prodding the laggard states. Race to the Top was about building on that, but instead of prodding laggards, it was about rewarding the leaders, rewarding states that were either really doing avant-garde and really forward-looking things, or states that were willing to commit to do those things as part of the Race to the Top competition. And the points in Race to the Top was really half were for sort of what you'd done and half were for what you were committing to do. And so right now, you have 12 winners, and they are out there sort of trying to implement their plans, and I think you're seeing sort of varying degrees of success and challenges on that in a few years. We'll have a sense on how well that initiative worked and what we can learn and draw from it.
I think for teachers, there's something very major and common about No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, and that is the emphasis on testing, on measuring by testing. And I think a lot of teachers feel that they are being forced to teach to the test, to teach so that kids do well on the test. And that it's limiting their creativity as teachers, and it's limiting what they can actually focus on. Do you think that that's a legitimate complaint, judging from your experience and from your analysis of the data?
Sure. There's some validity to that, of course. I think what you really see, and so let's just be clear what No Child Left Behind requires. It requires annual tests in math and in language arts, reading, in grades 3 through 8. Individual states do additional testing on top of that. Local districts do additional testing. So in a lot of places, teachers are under a burden of too much testing, but it's important to sort of disentangle where that doll comes from. What the law requires is once a year in grades 3 through 8. And the data from that is actually very valuable, and to the extent people want to have better accountability systems, want to have better ways of evaluating performance and so forth, that data is sort of a cornerstone for actually doing that. What we're seeing, and this is a very sort of hard and complicated conversation that unfortunately is clouded by a lot of frankly irresponsible rhetoric, a lot of schools struggle to deliver a really powerful instructional program for kids, and they struggled to do that before No Child Left Behind. Educational history in this country didn't start in 2001. And so what you see is a lot of anxiety about the test. You see a lot of really counterproductive strategies, drilling kids and so forth, cutting out subjects like social studies and so forth to focus on reading. When the best way, and research actually shows this, there's been studies on this, the best way to really teach kids in a rich way is to teach kids in a rich way. The schools that don't worry about the tests but actually focus on delivering a powerful curriculum and powerful instruction to kids, it shows up in the test scores, and they do okay. The schools that are struggling, it's because we have a lot of problems out there in terms of the capacity to really, at scale, And by at scale, I mean across schools for all kids, across districts for all kids, and across states for all kids, deliver really high quality instruction. That's what's showing up. There's a whole bunch of things bound up in that, and it's creating a very contentious debate. Teachers have not been nearly as supported as they need to be in terms of reaching these standards. It's been more on the demand side than on the support side. They're understandably frustrated by that. The rules have basically changed. If you came into education 25 years ago, even 20 years ago, what you're being asked to do now is radically different than what you were asked to do when you came in. The expectations have changed and so forth. I mean, this is basically a very large industry that's in fairly rapid transformation. And so it's, you know, people are frustrated. They're understandably confused. They feel whipsawed. And again, I don't think policymakers have done enough to support teachers. But underneath this, again, is the kernel of this problem, that when you have a system that produces 8% of the kids getting out of college, of low-income kids getting out of college by the time they're 24, something is wrong. And to the extent we focus only on shooting the messenger, we're missing the larger problem.
There's a lot of criticism now of teachers' unions and of tenure. From your experience, do you think that teachers' unions and teacher tenure are part of the problem in education?
Well, tenure is kind of a misnomer. What we're really talking about with tenure is sort of a set of rules and regulations and due process proceedings and so forth for teachers who have been teaching after a certain period of time, and it varies from you know, usually it's in the neighborhood of a couple of years. So it's not tenure as we sort of think about it in terms of higher education. I mean, don't take my word for it. Randi Weingarten recently gave a talk where she was talking about some reforms at the AFT, which is the second largest
She's the head of the country. Union.
Right, she's the head of the American Federation of Teachers, and she was talking about some reforms they support. And Randy said, you know, in some places, tenure's become a job for life. She told that to CBS. So, I mean, I would defer to that. And I think it takes on, again, as a lot of these things do, sort of an outsized importance. If you were to sort of abolish, quote-unquote, tenure today, our school system would not sort of experience some sort of a renaissance. These issues are all sort of bound up part and parcel, and that's just one piece of it. You know, teachers' unions get blamed for a lot of things that aren't their fault. I mean, it is not the fault of the teachers' unions that funding is so inequitable within states, for instance, and in many ways it would probably be worse without them. I think if you really want to lay blame at their feet today, it would be, are they doing enough to help us address this challenge, and are they out in front enough in terms of addressing this challenge? And I would say right now the answer is no. But they get blamed sort of disproportionately in the debate to their actual influence. And I think if they were to sort of if they were to go away tomorrow, there'd be a lot of people would be disappointed sort of that in terms of what that would actually the changes that would actually bring. So they're a challenge. In some places they're leading and they're doing some interesting things. In other places they're clearly in the way. But they're not the only challenge that we face, and they need to be seen sort of in that larger context.
What would you like to see teachers' unions do to be out front in education reform?
I'd like to see them work to help us build more of a genuine profession. I mean, sort of this whole idea of industrial unionism, it really is at odds with sort of how really high-performing organizations that do the kind of work that schools do, and how sort of professionals like that are going to organize themselves, make decisions, govern themselves. And I'd like to see them sort of leading that conversation, because we really don't. We hear a lot of talk about teaching as a profession. We don't yet treat teachers as professionals, either on the reward side or the risk side, and what it means to be a professional. And they could lead that conversation.
Does what you're saying translate in a way to, we should treat teachers more professionally, attract the best teachers? Part of that is offering a professional salary. We're in a time now when the opposite is happening, I think, when states are looking for ways to cut back on teachers' salaries.
Yeah, we should be offering. I mean, this is, you know, we have pursued a strategy in education over the last 30 years of more. We've hired more and more teachers rather than thinking about, do you potentially hire fewer and pay them more. And so we're a little bit in a box of our own creation. Teachers do need to be paid more. They also need to be paid differently. And that's the second piece of this. We have to start differentiating salary much more. And performance pay sort of takes on this sort of outsized place in this debate. When we talk about differentiation, it's around sort of what subjects do you teach? It is easier to find teachers in some subjects than others. We have acute shortages in math, science, special education, foreign language. Where do you teach? Some schools are simply harder to staff than other schools. How can we differentiate and reward that? other kinds of things. We talk about this in monetary terms, but professionals are rewarded in other fields in non-monetary ways too, opportunities for professional growth, different kinds of training and so forth. We don't do any of those things at any scale for teachers. And those are sort of some of the basic aspects of being a professional. So it's pay, but it's also much more. And then with that comes this different kind of accountability, this different kind of risk that you have in professional work, and just a different way things are organized. Professionals, you're not organized around sort of contracts. We don't talk about contractual days and these kinds of things. These are the sorts of changes that have to happen. But again, they're controversial. It's really changing how things have been for a long time, and that's, you know, understandably contentious. And this is a subject of a recent column I did for Time. We don't know exactly. It's not as if there's a template out there, and if we could only apply it, we'd be better off. There's going to be a lot of innovation. There's going to be a lot of trial and error. We haven't done this and paid attention to this in education for so long. And so, you know, no one's going to get it right on the first stroke.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Andrew Rotherham is a partner at Bellwether Education Partners and writes a column for Time.com. You can find links to his blogs on our website, freshair.npr.org. A recent DVD box set from Classic Media presents for the first time the complete adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends, hundreds of installments of Rocky the Flying Squirrel and Bullwinkle the Moose, as well as Fractured Fairy Tales, Dudley Do-Right, and Mr. Peabody, the genius dog with a pet boy named Sherman. These primetime TV cartoons go back about 50 years, and our TV critic David Bianculli says that while watching them all over again, so did he.
The TV cartoon series most people refer to as Rocky and Bullwinkle actually was two shows with two different titles shown on two different networks. Rocky and His Friends came first in 1959. And when ABC canceled that series after 2 years, NBC picked up the ball the very next night to present The Bullwinkle Show, which ran from 1961 to 1964. Both shows were co-created by Jay Ward and Bill Scott, and both were aimed at adults as much as children. Back then, I thought these shows were just about the best television ever made. Half a century later, after conning my way into watching TV for a living, I still do. I had just turned 6 when Rocky and His Friends premiered, and the show arrived on TV like a birthday present meant just for me. It was the first TV show I remember staying up late to watch and waiting eagerly for each new installment to arrive. Through the years, each 30-minute program had different ingredients but the same basic format. A serialized adventure of Rocky and Bullwinkle would open and close each show. In between would be other features, just as warped and just as funny. During the first season, for example, Bullwinkle would recite poetry or offer little-known facts as Mr. Know-It-All. And Mr. Peabody, the time-traveling talking dog, would set his Wayback Machine, and he and his pet boy, Sherman, would visit famous moments in history. And then there was my favorite. Fractured Fairy Tales. These short cartoons were narrated by Edward Everett Horton, who had the most soothing TV voice this side of Fred Rogers. He told, or retold, familiar fairy tales, but with wickedly modern spins. In this first season take on Sleeping Beauty, for example, the voice of the prince is provided by Dawes Butler, who later played Yogi Bear. And when this prince discovers his Sleeping Beauty, his unique reaction owes its inspiration to a famous theme park that had opened just 4 years before.
The prince made straight for the tower rooms.
Sleeping Beauty! I've come at last! With one kiss, I shall waken you and... Wait a minute. Awake, she's just another princess. Asleep, she's a gold mine. I can see it now. Sleeping Beauty comics, Sleeping Beauty hats, Sleeping Beauty bubble gum, and biggest of all, Sleeping Beauty Land.
Sure enough, the castle was soon made ready as a great tourist attraction. There was moat land.
Have your X coupons ready, please. Have your X coupons ready.
There was entrance hall land.
Y coupons, please.
There was stair land.
That's a Z coupon, folks. A Z coupon.
And of course, Sleeping Beauty herself.
In later years, Fractured Fairy Tales would give way to other features, like Dudley Do-Right of the Mounties. But Rocky and Bullwinkle remained constant, with their adventures pitting them against Cold War spies Boris and Natasha. I was well into my 20s when I finally put it together that Boris Badenov was a play on an opera called Boris Godunov. But some jokes I got right away, and they still make me laugh. Like the episode where Rocky and Bullwinkle take a wheelbarrow full of box tops, which kids used to save to send in for prizes, and try to deposit them at their local bank.
Could we have a little service, please?
Yes, sir. Certainly, sir. Arbogast, call the police. The FBI. My wife.
I'd like to start a box top account with your bank.
Yes, sir. What kind? Just checking?
No, I really mean it.
Meanwhile, a bevy of law enforcement officers were...
Clearly, this is where my love of puns and bad jokes comes from. And my love of satire. And I know I'm not alone. Matt Groening told me once that if not for Mad Magazine and Rocky and Bullwinkle, he probably never would have had his sense of humor or love of cartoons. And all he did was go off and create The Simpsons, the longest-running animated series in TV history. But Rocky and Bullwinkle was there first, entertaining us all and influencing a lot of us. It's a delight to have the entire series in one set to relive the early days. The animation, especially on the ABC series, is pretty crude. But the humor, time and again, hits it out of the park.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.